Welcome to Just Wanna Quilt, a research podcast coming out of Tulane University Law School, where we explore all kinds of things, stories about quilting, tools, field trips, maybe some famous quilters stop by, and of course, a little bit of copyright thrown in just for fun. I'm Dr. Elizabeth Townsend-Gard. I'm a law professor, and I just wanna quilt. Today, I had the pleasure of interviewing Vanessa Vargas Wilson, or as most people know her, the Crafty Gemini. And she is so amazing. So she is fun and super clever, and she gave us a lot of time. So this is a two-part interview with the Crafty Gemini, talking about how she became the Crafty Gemini, her strategy, and monetizing what she does. It is cool. Hope you enjoy.
Okay, great.
Let me see. Okay, go for it. Say hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. All right. So what we're going to do is, well, thank you again for being willing to chat. I'm super interested in everything you're doing. You're really amazing.
No, thank you.
Yeah, I really, really can't wait to hear your story. So this is a research podcast. We're trying to understand the quilting industry from all aspects of it, from someone who just has some of their grandparents' quilts or grandmother's quilts to serious sure. industry people, and I think you're the wave of the future. So I'm really interested to hear your story and sort of how you feel you fit within the whole world of crafting and quilting.
Awesome.
Does that sound good? We usually go about half hour to 45 minutes, maybe an hour. If we find that we haven't gotten to everything, we've done a part two with people on another day if you mm-hmm. want to do that. So,
okay.
So that's pretty much it. We start with the you can answer anything you want. And you don't mm-hmm. have to answer stuff you don't want. And if there's anything you want to chat about for the project, but you'd prefer not to have on, broadcast to people, then just let me know. Or okay. we can talk off. I can stop the recording and we can chat. Or if there's something later you think you don't want that as part of it, I can edit it out too.
Okay.
Does that sound good? Okay. Okay. One more second. I just got to get to notes. Oh, goodness, there's a lot of technology in the world. Okay. All right. Okay, cool. All right, so we start with the first question. Everybody, the same question is, what is your first memory of someone quilting or sewing in your life?
In my life, you said?
Yeah, in your life.
Okay.
What's your first memory?
So my first memory, I would say where I actually remember. I mean, I knew of it, but that I remember, I would say would have to be in maybe around age 8, my mom making our clothes. And so she would often lay out the pattern pieces on the dining room table. And we always had a sewing machine in our house. She kept it in like the laundry room, like the utility room. And it was an industrial Singer sewing machine. So that would be my first memory of I didn't really know what it was. You know, like when you're a kid and you kind of grow up around something, you don't really like think twice, like, oh, my mother has a sewing machine. It was just like always there.
Right.
But it was an industrial sewing machine, which I think is not very common even today for the typical home sewer. But because my mom came to this country in the 60s as a teenager, she worked in the garment district in New York City. And so, you know, she worked making clothes, and that was all on industrial machines. So she was more like of an industry seamstress.
Interesting.
And so back in those days, you know, you got paid by the piece. So although the industrial machines were super fast, obviously they're still faster, you know, than the home sewing machine, of course, because it's industry stuff. And so she got paid by the piece. So the faster you were, the more money you made. And as a teenager, you know, in comparison to the older elderly ladies that worked there, she was super fast. And so she would often sew her fingers under the sewing machine
needle. Oh my gosh, really?
Yes. So that's actually why she never taught us to sew. Because when I would see her doing it, I was always, and we were always like that. I'm one of four girls. And my mom was always a single mom, you know, and she was always very resourceful. I think a combination of her having kind of an engineer-y type of a mind, being a seamstress, being used to making stuff, and also not having the money to buy stuff. So we just grew up in a household of you made stuff, you know? So I remember making my own board games for school assignments. Like I would go over and beyond. Like you had to do a regular assignment, I'd be like, I'm going to make a board game that shows this topic. And so we always made stuff. And so I think personality wise, I was always very, you know, attentive to detail, very responsible. I mean, I was cooking by myself in the kitchen by the age of 6. So it's not like she didn't trust me, right, you know, to try my hand at sewing. She was just really traumatized because we had an industrial machine. I mean, imagine 1500, 2000 stitches per minute.
Amazing.
I would love to have that today. I mean, I have one that's 1500 stitches per minute. And it's funny because I'm super fast too, you know, but like, right, of course you're a kid. And so she was traumatized that that would happen to us. And she always, I mean, I'd ask her every other year, every year, teach me how to sew. And she'd say, nope, you're not old enough. Nope, you're not old enough, since I was 8. And so I saw of it. I mean, I remember sometimes when she would be gone, I would turn on the machine and just floor the foot pedal. And it was so fast that I was like, wow. but I mean, of course, I never put my finger under it or nothing, but she never let me sew. And so I grew up creating all types of other stuff. And I remember, I think it was my 6th grade gifted class. Our teacher would teach us about the world and we'd memorize countries and capitals. And she always tied it in with some type of a different project, whether it was art, creating clay, stuff out of clay, ceramics. And I remember one time she dumped out like a bin of fabric scraps and we had to create a pillow picking out some indigenous culture from around the world, you know? And so we had to create these pieces and face, like the lips, the eyes, and you're just using random prints of fabric. And I remember making that by hand and thinking, this is amazing. But that was it, really. I couldn't take it one step further. You know, we had garment sewing, like apparel fabrics at home, which is not the quilting cottons of today.
Yeah.
And my mom wouldn't let me touch that stuff anyways, you know? So I was branching out to other types of creative stuff. I mean, I made and decorated cakes when I was in high school, and I just really made everything. So I always tell my mom, I'm like, if you would have taught me, who knows what, you know, she's like, you probably would have hated it. And I'm like, no, you know, that's not true, because it doesn't make sense. I created everything else, you know, any type of medium, I created stuff. And that was the only one that she wouldn't let me do.
Super interesting. Okay. I've got a bunch of follow-up questions. First.
Sure.
What about your kids? Have you taught them sewing?
It's the complete opposite, because I don't want them to be 22 and learning how to sew when their mom sews for a living. You know what I mean?
Right.
So
right.
I actually went the complete opposite, to the point where I get people telling me like, you're crazy, you're insane, this is child neglect.
Yeah.
Because I put my kid on a sewing machine at age 3.
That's great. That's good. I did mine at 5. Yes. Mine was at 5, but she was also ironing. But I thought, you know, she'll be fine.
Exactly. I feel like if you show them how you do it, and it's like, right, and I did a video on this on YouTube called Teaching Kids How to Sew, because a lot of people would ask me, they'd say, oh, I seen you teaching a little kid, you know, my 10-year-old daughter, or my 12-year-old granddaughter comes over and she wants me to teach her, but I have no idea where to start.
Yeah.
So for me, I'm really big on, and as a homeschooling mom too, you know, like if you teach them to appreciate the risks involved, they're not going to go for it. Like my kids always, they knew how to use a knife from when they were little. So I don't have to worry about them seeing a knife on the counter and trying to grab it by the blade, because they know what it does, you know?
Yeah.
So the same thing for sewing, I think, with real scissors and real sewing machines. So they see me do it. You know, I don't cut or sew myself, so you don't do it either.
Right.
And I just taught them like that. Plus, of course, you know, you got to know when the child is ready too. My son was super attentive to detail, very meticulous and careful. I mean, even as a toddler, he never fell or hurt himself, because unless he's 120% sure that he can do something, he won't even attempt it. So with that type of a character, I was like, he'll be fine, you know, because he's very, very careful.
Interesting. Very interesting. All right. So when did you start? So, and you can kind of see from the beginning of your story why what you do is, there's so much variance, because you are just kind of creative, like, it's in, like, your whole body is creative, I imagine. Like,
it is.
Everything is about
and it's, it's funny that you say creative, because, you know, when you ask artists or designers, they, like, how do they describe themselves? You know, some people, like, I don't consider myself creative or an artist. Mm-hmm. I'm really, like, super practical, I think, so I just consider myself a maker. You know, I make stuff not because I'm, you know, I have this fabulous idea of the colors and the design. Like, that's not me. I make the stuff because I need it, you know, for something. So when, you know, when I design quilts, it's hard because people are like, oh, I saw these gorgeous fabrics. And I'm like, yeah, they're pretty, but I'm like, I need a picnic quilt, you know, something we can throw at the beach and my kids can just destroy. So I come from a more practical perspective, I think, as being a first generation American, the child of immigrants, like we just always had to be resourceful.
That's interesting.
You know, you always had to make do. And so I think even as a kid, I kind of turned it into a game. You know, now that I'm an adult, you know, I can look back on these times and it's like, yeah, you know, it was fun for me. It's stressful and anxiety filled for an adult even to be in some of these scenarios. But for me, it was like, you know, you're a kid, you're resilient, you deal with what you have to do. And I turned it into a game. So for me, the more limited I am, the more parameters I have to design something within, the more, like the less choice and less options I have, the better I do and the more I thrive.
That's really interesting. You know,
it is. And for me, like I realize it, I'm like, I like to just be up against the wall hard. Like you have to make this happen. You don't know how, it seems impossible. Maybe people tell you it's impossible. And that, right, that's my motivation. That for me is like, okay, watch me. And then I come out of it on the other side and I'm like, ooh, I did it. Checkbox. Yeah. And like, I literally forget it. My husband, if I have to do a bio or something, I'm like, what did I do? And he reminds me of all these things. And I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot. Because for me, it's like a challenge accomplished. Next challenge, please.
Interesting. Okay. I have 1,000 things to ask you. So
sure.
We'll do your super quick journey. So you anthropology, BA.
That's right.
How does anthro help you with what you do now?
I think when I decided I wanted to go to law school, it was kind of like, well, let me find out, how do you get in? And it was, you know, you just had to have great grades. It didn't matter what your major was. So then at that point I was like, you know what, forget this. I'm just going to do something that I love. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up with an interesting type of life experience because we didn't have any money. Mm-hmm. But my mother worked for American Airlines. So this is pre 9/11. So even though I didn't have any money, I could travel for free in the continental US and Caribbean, right? And so even if I did travel abroad, it was a fraction of what a regular person would have to pay, right? So as a part of the One World Alliance with American Airlines, you know, like employee little newspaper, they would have an ad on there where like I could pay, I think it was like $125 or something, and they would match me up with another kid that had the same travel benefits in another country. So whereas, you know, what do I look like traveling by myself with these benefits? It was like, hey, there's another person that can travel for the same price as you and you get to see more stuff together. And so I did that one summer and they matched me up with a girl whose mother worked for Lufthansa, the German airlines. And so I spent a summer in Germany. So here I am broke, work a little side job as a teenager. And that was enough of my money saved up that I could spend a summer in Europe, you know? So being able to travel and seeing what else was out there, even though it wasn't from like a privilege perspective, was really, really eye-opening for me. And so I think having that part of it in there was what made me go to anthropology, because I loved language, culture, people. And so because I got a taste of traveling the world, I went back to that. And I always did. You know, when it comes to language, culture, music, food, I love all that stuff. And I love people. And I love, in college, it was funny because you get a mix of people from everywhere. And I would just sit around and be like, are you from Egypt? And they'd be like, how did you know? And I'm like, I can tell. I'm like, your last name is this and that. And like, that was just like my thing, you know? That's great. And that's the anthro part of it.
Yeah.
I just love people, language, culture, all that kind of, you know, human perspective and understanding of different things that's around really the world.
Cool. And law school, why law school?
Well, what am I going to do with a BA in anthro, right? Like, it was like, I think I have to go to grad school. And so for us, of course, as you know, kids of immigrants and my mother coming to this country. And that was the only thing for us. Education, education, education.
Yeah.
From day one, it was education. Like, I didn't even know there was another option. Like, you had to go to college. You had to keep going.
Yeah.
And so for us, whenever I tell my mom, like, oh, I don't know what I want to do. Get another degree. You know, that's all she would say. I'd be in law school. Like, I hate this. Get another degree. Get a PhD. And I'm like, this is student loans now. Like, okay, I got scholarship in undergrad.
Right.
I got assistantships and some scholarships in law school. But now it's student loans. Like, you have no money. You're not paying for this. It's me.
Right.
And
right.
So for me, it was kind of like, MBA, law school. And I literally remember thinking, you know, law school sounds like it has more pull. Maybe it'll help me figure something out that's a little bit less generic than business.
Yeah.
And I went to law school. I mean, I hated every day of it, but I went through it. I graduated.
You it was the worst. So tell me what, so I'm a law professor and I wasn't a traditional, like most law professors are like the super smart top of the class.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really one of those because I have a PhD in European history and I'm kind of quirky and I do intellectual property. Yeah. So I'm like not of this right elk of, you know, traditional elk.
Yeah, yeah.
But sort of what did you focus on in law school and why did you hate it so much? Because of the lack of creativity?
Yeah. So for me, I'll tell you straight up, I hate reading. I don't know why I went to law school. But again, it was a challenge, right? I wasn't going to quit. There was no way I was going to quit. Yeah. But from day one, from orientation, you can ask my friends. I was like, I'm leaving. Tomorrow's my last day. And they're like, yeah, okay. You know, like every single, like literally every day. And my friend looks at me at graduation. We're sitting there. And she's like, hey, today's your last day, huh? I'm like, I know.
I love that.
A couple of the things I hated about it was the – it's like a spectacle, right? This show of the Socratic method like drilling you to try and put you down. Like it just felt to me like it wasn't about, and I had a graduate assistantship because I did 1 year of a joint master's and in Latin American studies and law. Cool.
Yeah.
And so in the same time being exposed to graduate school and
totally
law school,
right?
Such
it's
a
so
difference,
different.
My goodness.
Oh my gosh. There's like there's a respectability in grad school.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Right? They treat you like a person. If you're struggling,
totally.
They try to understand where you're coming from.
I know.
Come and see me. Let's discuss this as a class. Like it just feels more personable.
Exactly.
And no matter what you're struggling with, I mean, you have people there that are career changing, people going back to school. You have kids straight from under. It's just like this variety. But there's like, again, like respect for everybody. Like everybody has a voice in that class, you know? And so part of what law school too for me was, I just felt like I didn't have a voice.
Yeah.
I clerked for an immigration attorney for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And most of that was before and during law school. And so coming into law school with that experience, I was the only one that spoke Spanish at this firm for most of the time I was there. And I had my hands in every case. I mean, from asylum cases to you know, sponsored visas and all this stuff. And I had my hands in every single thing. I still couldn't even talk about that. Like for my seminar paper, I did it on like the effect of undocumented immigrants in the U.S. economy. Mm-hmm. I couldn't say anything that I knew from my experience and my time. My professor's like, that's great. Find somebody to quote, like that has more authority than you. Like you're nobody. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so out of a 26 page paper, it was like 11 original sentences. I was like, when do I get to say something?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so for me, as talkative as I am, as expressive as I am, and as assertive as I am, like I always have always been like, I want to put my two cents in.
Yeah.
It just felt like, shut up, shut up, shut up. Like this constant, just like, be quiet. This is how we do it. I don't care what you think. It doesn't matter. Like that to me was insane. And so.
Did you find that it was gendered too? Did you find that?
Somewhat. And for my school too. I mean, in my class, this is like the flagship school of the state. It's what they call a PWI, like a predominantly white institution.
Mm-hmm.
In a class of over 100 students, it was 5 of us that were students of color. You know what I mean? So in these class discussions, it was
That's
like,
crazy.
are you serious right now? Like, is this real life?
It's a problem,
and you're thinking,
right?
It is.
Because what happens in those classes, and we'll get back to quilting, is that who's in the class really, I mean, the makeup of the class matters because of life experience, of perspective.
Of course.
And it's really difficult when you have only 5 minorities in a school. Yeah, it's not good.
And it was super disappointing for me too, because I left undergrad and it was at the same school, you know, so it was like, okay, because it's undergrad, you know, whatever, I'm going to law school. Like this is elevated. These people are, you know, the creme de la creme. Like these are the students that I went to school with are like top attorneys in the state, like legislators, judges, like these are their kids I went to law school with.
Mm-hmm.
So to hear these same people that you know are going to have this type of effect on your direct local and state community was like, is this real life? Like where am I right now? Like you can't, this is not going to change, you know?
Yeah.
So that was tough for me. So it was really a depressing time.
No, I'm sorry.
Not to mention I didn't have any money. So I had to petition for first year, you know, 1Ls, you're not supposed to work. I had to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually took a job at Joann's Fabrics, making $7.10 an hour with a BA cum laude from the University of Florida. My mom was like, are you kidding me? You're wasting your time. And I remember telling her, you know, it's not about the money. I didn't have money to buy fabric like that.
Yeah.
So just putting the bolts back where they went was so satisfying and relaxing for me, because I would just think like, oh, this would make such a cute skirt.
Yeah.
Oh, this would make such a cute quilt with these fabrics. Oh, and being able to like, even in just in my head, be in that creative space was like literally what got me through law school. I mean, my paychecks were like $42 straight up. And then you're eating peanut butter and jelly sandwich next to somebody who's like, my dad just called. He surprised me with a wedding dress fund. Apparently I have 35 grand to buy the wedding dress I've always wanted. Yeah. And like, you're eating a PB&J and you don't know how you're going to pay the rent. You know, like it's,
there's a lot, it was of that a lot. With law school.
It's, oh yeah. It was just like a lot all the way around. No, and
I'm
so
sorry to hear that.
I found that being around fabrics and creating and textiles, like that was like my happy place.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I told my mom, I was like, listen, I'm 22. I think I can keep my fingers away from the needle. You need to teach me how to sew. So she was like, okay, let me go to a garage sale and see what machine I can find you. So she found me like a 1966 Singer, one of the first zigzag stitch machines. She drove up here, brought it to me, and then she showed me how to thread it. And I'm like, okay, now what? And she's like, stitch 1,000 straight lines. And I'm like, are you kidding me? And she's like, there's nothing more important than sewing straight, you know? So I'm like, okay, I did a few straight lines. I'm like, I'm sewing straight. I need to make something. So she went home and I literally went to my closet, pulled out an old pair of jeans that didn't fit me anymore, cut them up and started sewing. I mean, I would sew the stuff wrong sides together. And then I looked at him like, yeah, that didn't work. Let's try it again. You know, like cut the seam off, flip it right sides out and then sew it again. I'm like, okay. And that's just even in my house, just inventing like that trial and error.
Yeah.
Then I started seeking out classes and I would sit in the back row in my law classes, second and third year. Mm-hmm. I would skip class just to go to a quilting class. And my friends would laugh. They're like, you're the only 22-year-old that's like skipping out of class to go sew with a bunch of grandmas. And I'm like, man, I love every second of it. Yeah. Okay.
When I was in grad school, our apartment building was right next to a quilting shop.
So oh my gosh.
I know. And I was, you know, it was my escape too, because it was like, okay, well, these people don't care whether I've done my reading or not.
That's it. You got it. They're just like, oh, cute fabrics. Oh, what are you going to make? You know, like it's
so
just
loving compared to the sort of experience of law.
Exactly. I absolutely agreed. And so I started making stuff. Like I'd make a messenger bag and take it to school. And people were like, you made that? And I'm like, yeah, you want to buy one? You know? Like, and so that's how I started. That's literally what got me through my last couple of years of law school, you know, to where I was like, you know what? This is not even, I'm just, you know, I'm going to finish. I'm going to do what I need to do, but this is not my happy place. And I know for sure I'm not going to be an attorney ever.
All right, so
like,
how did you get, so next steps, you graduate and you taught a little, you taught at a
Community college. I taught it. They have a like a paralegal program.
Yeah.
And so I taught there and I actually, I think it's, I'm a teacher first and foremost, right? Regardless of what I'm teaching. It just happens to be that I have this love for teaching and I have a love for learning. So I think it's like this unique combination that whatever I learn, I do something halfway successfully and I'm like, oh, that was easy. I can teach it. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like whatever I learn, I teach. And my goal really is to like learn as much as I can about as much as I can. So I never really limit myself like, oh, I'm not interested in that. I'm like, well, maybe one day I'll need it, you know? And so I like to learn a little bit about everything. And so what I liked about teaching, even though it was law and I hated law stuff, but it was paralegal program. So it was practical stuff.
Yeah.
It wasn't all this theory. It wasn't the Socratic method. It was like, when the attorney tells you need to do this, this is what you need to do.
Right.
In the real world, this is how it works, you know? And I loved it because one of the reasons, I mean, I was the youngest one in the room because at a community college, you know, a lot of these people were career changing grown-ups, like grown-ups.
Yeah.
And so they're looking at me like, this is our teacher. Like I'm handing out the syllabi. Right. And they're like, is this a TA or like what's going on?
Right.
But I loved it because I was able to take the complex legal jargon stuff, because even those books, you know, it's legal stuff. Mm-hmm. And break it down to them in a way that like the everyday person can understand and see how it's applied in regular life.
Yeah.
I like to take complex things and break it down in just like eighth grade language. Like this is, guys, you don't have to get scared. You don't have to be nervous. Like, oh, I don't understand. This is too fancy. I'm not that smart. You know, they think all these things. And that's one of the things I wondered in law school too. I'm like, why are y'all making it so much harder than it has to be? Like common sense, you know, like I just,
yeah.
And I like to just break it down to regular terms. And so that's what I liked about that.
Well, that's really cool. Okay, well, I want to move into your current life.
Sure.
A couple of things. And what I'd love to do is really sort of break down both what you do and how you do it and how you became what you are, which is incredible. A little bit about the economics and the logistics. I have a feeling that you're able to do as much as you do because you've got a lot. You're a can-do, get-things-done kind of person, but we'll learn more of that. Your audience, the industry, And then I just want to start with saying that the reason I know you is because, I told you this in the email I sent you, when I was looking for, I really wanted to learn to free motion quilt it, and I wanted a big machine. And so I found your Juki 2010 review.
You're like, sight unseen. I'm like, that's awesome. Right.
And so I had, there are no Juki dealers in New Orleans. So I had to, there was no way to test it. So, but it was exactly what I wanted. And I watched your interview and I just trusted you. There was something about you that was like amazing. So my law school business, you'll like this. My law, the law school purchased the machine.
That's awesome. Oh, my word.
I know. Do you like that?
I love that story. Yes.
And then
there you go, law school.
Exactly. And then I had to travel this summer. So I explained to them that the Juki 2010 is kind of like a desktop and I needed a laptop. So so I could travel with the machine. And I looked around and I went back to you and I got a Juki Exceed because
awesome.
And so that's my connection to you. So I feel more connected to you.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
Yeah. So I had to tell you that you've influenced my life on a daily basis, which is awesome. So
cool. Okay.
So you are like a superstar. You're YouTube. You've got all over the place. You've done a lot of really cool stuff, and you're not an attorney. You are full time with this, and you're called. Tell everyone what your name is online, so in case they want to.
Sure.
Yeah.
So my online name is Crafty Gemini.
Yeah.
You can if you do a Google search for a Crafty Gemini or the Crafty Gemini, anything I've ever done will pop up on YouTube. The channel itself is called The Crafty Gemini, but everywhere else is just Crafty Gemini. My website, craftygemini.com. And I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I'm really active on Facebook and Instagram more than the others also for daily happenings and different things that's going on. But it's under Crafty Gemini on those as well.
How did all this begin?
All right.
You graduated from law school and you're teaching at a community college.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I graduated from law school. I didn't want to be an attorney. I took a job at the same university, but in undergraduate admissions office. So when I was in law school, it's so funny because I hated law school, but I worked in the recruitment office and I would go to events all around the country and tell kids about how amazing our law school was because it was, it just wasn't for me. You know what I mean? But I've always had this kind of salesy thing, right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
I've always done great at sales, even if I'm selling stuff that I didn't like. So it's easier for me if I'm enthusiastic and I like something, it just comes off and people just, they believe it and they buy it. You know what I mean? Whatever.
Well, you sold me. So
I met my husband after I graduated from law school and we dated for 4 months and got married. And he told me, he's like, when you told me that you were making that kind of money, like I used to work for T-Mobile selling cell phones, right? In Miami, Florida, which is super, saturated, such a shark and hustling kind of community. And it's all about the dollars and you're getting paid on commission. So you got to hustle for every dollar you're making. And I made, I don't know, maybe like 20 something thousand dollars in like 4 months, just working part time because people would come in and you made more money off of selling them like the data plans, like a phone, Blackberries, the HP phones, things that had data plans, but I don't do that. I'm like, where do you work? Okay. A guy would come in and tell me he works at the airport. I'm like, you're not going to get good reception with any of these. The best reception is going to be with this phone that's actually, and so like that, people would then start coming in with their entire family, switching them from other companies.
Because
and if they ask for my name,
right?
Because I just keep it real. I just want to be real with people and just help them. It's not whatever.
I mean, I have to say, Vanessa, that you did that with me. I mean,
awesome. Yay!
I spent a lot of money, the law school spent a lot of money on machines.
Yeah.
And it was
they're not cheap. That's why I was like, that's crazy.
That's a leap of faith, right? And part of that's sort of that's your brand, right? That's who you are. You feel connected to you. You feel real. You feel like, it's funny because I was watching some of the videos that you've produced and I'm so quilty and I'm not practical in any way. And I'm like, I want to make that. like you make people feel like they can do it.
I love it. I'm glad you're saying that because that's exactly what I tried to do because even as a student myself, if I see stuff, I'm like, why are they making it so hard? I know that it doesn't have to be that hard, but if you don't know, you're going to be like, oh, I'm not worthy. Because this is what I see a lot, especially when you teach in person at retreats or classes.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's like a woman thing, if it's like just an older person. I don't know what it is, but it's this constant apology for everything they do. Yeah. They just have like no confidence, no self-esteem. Oh, I don't think I can do that. Oh, I'm so sorry for bothering you again. Oh, I'm so sorry for asking another question. And it's like, look, stop. Right. Okay. It's hard because you don't know it. But that's why you either paid me money to come to a class or why you're watching this video. Believe in yourself a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think that's huge for me to like show the step by step. Because even if you don't do it, even if you don't have a machine, let's play and walk. By the end, you'll be like, you know what? It's not that hard. I might buy it. My tutorials, because a lot of times, and you know, you have police up good enough that you didn't do it right. Like, come on. Seriously, there's so many more stressful and pressure issues that we have in our lives as adults this year. I mean, and really what it is, do you feel like it's that for you, quilting and sewing and creating? It's therapeutic, you know, to make something, especially as quilters. I feel like, hey, why would you, you know, stress yourself out? Just enjoy the process. Who cares if it's not perfect?
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. All right. So how did you become who you are today? So tell us a little bit about mm-hmm. the journey, and then I will talk more about the logistics.
Sure. So I graduated from law school, met my husband at the job in admissions, and we dated for 4 months and got married. We left on our honeymoon. The next year I had my son. And so when I was pregnant with him, I wasn't working. And so I told my husband, you know, I'm going to start making some stuff for the nursery, like just practicing my sewing skills. And so I was on Facebook then and just putting up on my personal page, you know, oh, look at the cloth diapers I made for the baby. This is what I did for the nursery, blah, blah, blah. So my friends, we were all in our mid-20s, started having kids too, and they'd place orders. Hey, can you make me a diaper bag? And I'd say, well, you know, I'm not working, so let me just do a little bit of this on the side and bring some money in. And then, like, I'd make 2 diaper bags, and I'm like, I'm tired. Like, I don't want to make the same project twice. Mm-hmm. And so I told my husband, I'm over it. So he says, well, why don't you teach classes? You know, because you love it so much, just teach other people how to do it. So I reached out to the community college, and I started teaching through community education classes. And we had a spare room in our house that was my studio. So I would teach, you know, 2 or 3 students there sometimes. But then it was like everybody wanted me to teach the same class. And I'm like, I'm over it. If I have to teach how to make a pillowcase dress one more time, I'm going to shoot myself, you know? Yeah. So my husband says, well, calm down. He says, why don't we videotape you creating the project? And then it's saved and archived, and you only ever have to make it once. And I'm like, you're a genius. Let's do it. So we didn't have any money at the time, and YouTube was the only free platform. Like, I didn't even watch videos on YouTube. I didn't know anything about YouTube, but it was free.
And what year is this?
2009. Okay. So my son was born in August, and so I got on YouTube November 2009. So whenever the baby was taking a nap, I'd tell my husband, grab the little point-and-shoot camera that we had mm-hmm. and go in the room and let's film a tutorial randomly. I mean, it wasn't like planned or produced. It was just like, come, let me do a tutorial on fusible applique. Come on.
Yeah.
And it's funny when I think about it, we had a point and shoot camera, and my memory card on it was like 256 megabytes. Okay. So you tell me how many seconds long of a video clip I could record at a time.
Amazing.
Nothing. It was a joke. I mean, like, I'd record 30 seconds. I'd take the card out, put it in the computer, take the footage off, clear it, put it back in the thing, film the next minute. I mean, it was insanity. Okay. It was crazy.
That's amazing.
And so then I started doing that. And after like the second or third video, I fired my husband, because when I'd get to editing the footage, I'd be like, you see me pointing over here. Why do I see your toes in the shot, dude? You're fired. And because, you know, I didn't have money for like a legit tripod, I got on eBay and was looking like, what can I put this camera on to still get the angle? Because for me, it was always been very important to show the point of view of the maker, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah,
because I noticed, you know, on a lot of the PBS shows and shows on TV, it's more about the pretty set or the cute host. And so when you're creating, they're showing you the angles backwards. Right. So if I'm looking at somebody from the front and you're saying, okay, you're going to fold this side and hem it this way, like, it's in reverse. You're already adding an extra level of confusion to a beginner. They're never going to try that project.
Yeah.
You know, it's too much. So I'm like, I have to do it from my eyes. I want people to be able to pause the video, do that step, press play, pause again, do that step, and like literally be side by side doing it the exact same way they see me doing it. Yeah. And so I found a little tripod that was like 5 inches long, and it was $2.99 on eBay, and it just screwed to the bottom of your point and shoot camera. And so I used that, and you can imagine with 5 inches, I mean, what kind of a shot you were going to get. But I put it inside my sports bra, and it had those pliable legs, and so I would just tilt it forward from my chest. Uh-huh. And so then I would, like, tighten my chest so it wouldn't move, and then I would so that you could see both my hands in the shot, you know, because I can't hold a camera with one hand. Right. And so then I would hold it as steady as I could, and I would, you know, show the steps to creating it. And I remember thinking, somebody's going to ask me where the camera is because they don't see. It's so close up. It's not like an aerial shot, you know, but you can still see both my hands. And somebody did ask me once in a comment, and I was like, trust me, you don't want to know.
Some secrets and must stay secret.
Yeah. And so again, it's like that resourcefulness where it's like, here's the challenge presented. Right. Watch me do it. You know, like that's, and so that's what I did for a lot, for 2 years almost. And in 2011, so in those 2 years, it's maybe 18 months or so of uploading videos, I would just, whenever I had time, film one, throw it up there. So that when people asked me.
Let me ask you a question about that. So when you're filming it, those early days, were you filming it at different angles and then editing them?
Oh, no, no. It was that one aerial shot, like the one shot from my chest. Yeah.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, sometimes it, for the intro parts where I show my face, like, hey, it's Vanessa, the crafty Gemini or whatever, I would stand a little bitty tripod. It would be like a chair with like four boxes and then like a thing on top. And so then the tripod with the camera and mm-hmm. tilt it a hair forward. You know what I mean? So I would just rig it up with the same little thing of how I can get the shot in front of me. And then I would edit it together. Yeah.
Interesting.
On, you know, Windows Movie Maker, like a joke, whatever came on the laptop.
Yeah.
That I had at the time. It was insane. But so then people, I would send people those videos, you know, hey, I don't know how to thread my sewing machine. It'd be like, here's the link, leave me alone. You know, so that's what my husband would say. So that way you just send them the link and tell them to leave you alone. You don't have time for that. You know, like, I'm not going to be making the same thing every time or teaching the same thing. So I was like, perfect. And then YouTube would send me emails every once in a while and say, hey, this video has 10,000 views. We'd like to monetize it. And I'd be like, perfect. And so because I didn't use YouTube and it wasn't like a business, it was just something that I did every, you know, like really passing by, I didn't know like what anything about YouTube. Mm-hmm. And so I thought to get revenue from the videos, you had to wait for them to send you that email every time your video hit a certain number of views, you know? Mm-hmm. So one day I did actually go to use YouTube and I was looking up something, advertisements running on it, and it only had 8 views. So I thought, I said, wait a minute, how did this girl get ads on this video and it only has 8 views?
Yeah.
So then I got to Google and started my researching and was like, how is this? And so then I came across the YouTube Partner Program where you could apply to monetize all your videos as a YouTube partner. And this was back then, you know, it's changed multiple times.
Yeah.
But back then you'd apply, they'd look through your video, your channel, and see that you were putting up quality content consistently on a consistent schedule and that you were getting views. And of course, you know, they approved me within 24 hours because I had like a ton. Some of my videos had like 50,000 views. And I'm like, what? I've been sleeping on this thing. I didn't know anything about this. And so then, like a month after that, I'm on YouTube again. And you know how it pops up these related videos on the right sidebar for you? Uh-huh. I see one that's like for a contest. And I'm like, are you serious? I got it. And they're like, YouTube and Google are looking for 25 up and coming video creators who have the potential to be the next big thing. Basically, they're looking for people who weren't big on YouTube. You had to have less than 10,000 subscribers. And they're basically looking to invest in you so that to grow your brand and your channel. Uh-huh. So I look and I'm crossing my fingers that the deadline hasn't passed. And of course it hadn't. So I had 4 days to submit an audition video. At this time I had a 1-year-old and I had a belly. I was maybe five, six months pregnant with my daughter with the second kid. So I tell my husband, here's your toddler and leave me alone for the next 4 days. At that point, we were already looking to buy some land and have like a little homestead. So my husband had sold his car and he gives me some money and he says, here's a chunk of it. I want you to get a good camera, like a legit camera. Cause he's like, I think you could really turn this into like a real money-making gig, you know?
That's really cool.
Yeah. And so I basically had 4 days to get a camera, get new editing software and teach myself how to use all of it. HD video, like this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And so I took those 4 days, made an audition video and submitted it and I won. So I mean, I told my husband, I remember thinking, I said, if I can submit it by the deadline, I'm like, I'm going to win. I'm like, my chances are fabulous. I'm like, it's 25 people. Like, I'm going to win, you know? And so I did. And great. I was actually from the list.
When was this? This is 2011?
This is, 2011. May 2011.
So, and YouTube at that point was up and running, but it wasn't like it is now, right? So
yeah, it's not like it is now. I mean, it was around since like, I think 05, maybe 06, 07. Yeah. I got on 2009, so it was still early on. There weren't many crafters on there at all. And so 2011, it was kind of like advertising. I mean, like the companies were starting to see, oh, wow, there's billions of views on this thing. There's, I don't know how many hours of video uploaded every day. Like this is a legit platform to advertise on. And so they were, you know, looking for brands that they could grow on there. And so, $35,000. They gave us $35,000 each.
That's amazing. That must have just been like, what am I going to
35 grand. I remember telling my husband, I was like, I'm rich. I mean, I went nuts. Are you crazy? For like a poor kid, like that was insane. I was like, I won the lotto. Like who gets 35K?
Right.
And so we bought, then they took us to, they flew to New York for a week. We went to B&H Photo Video Studio. We had like a private person to like walk us through the store, basically like a knowledgeable person of all the equipment to basically talk with you and be like, okay, what kind of videos do you shoot? What kind of lighting do you need? What do you need? And I'm like, I need a tripod that like goes high with an arm that can go over me for my tutorials. And they're like, okay, one of these, one of these. And we had like another additional $1,500 to spend at that store. And they just shipped everything to our houses. I was like, this is insanity. I've got a brand new iMac with Final Cut Pro. It was like, invest in this video production company now that you have, you know, to create quality videos. And so then the New York Times wrote a story on it. It was called YouTube Next Up. It was like their inaugural class. So I was one of those 25 there. And so we were in New York and we got to meet with like big time, like the people that put together the YouTube algorithms. And they're basically teaching us how to title your videos, how to fill in the metadata in the description boxes, how to build a community on YouTube, tips and tricks from everybody. I mean, do you know who Gary Vaynerchuk is?
No, tell me who that is.
So Gary V is like this crazy, massive media mogul guy. He was all into social media. If you look him up, it's like insane. He does keynotes all over the world. And he's just really big time and up ahead of the times in anything that's social media. And he came to speak to us like one-on-one. It was like, what is going on right now?
That's really great.
And he gave us a copy of his book. And so like we got to talk to all these people who have done that. You know, he ran like a video thing on Vimeo, or I think it's like one of the earlier video platforms on his like Wine Library TV, where he basically had a show that he would talk about wines and pairings for wine. And he grew that to a huge thing, you know? So now he has a media consulting company or whatever in New York City, like a huge media company called VaynerMedia. But he's huge. I mean, he's super, you know, millions and millions and millions of followers all over. And so I was like, yeah, I met Gary V. Like he came and talked to us and told us like how to grow our stuff. Cause he's like, you guys are up on the times. Like this is, YouTube is blowing up, blah, blah, blah. You know, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And out of the 25 winners, I was like the second from the bottom up with the least number of subscribers. I mean, really? I had maybe 2,500.
Interesting.
So it was like, okay, maybe I can do something with this. You know what I mean? Like, these people believe in me. They gave me a check for 35 grand. What's really going on? And so the New York Times wrote an article. The New York Times wrote an article on us. And the picture that accompanied it was a picture of me in front of a quilt shop in New York City. And then 2020 interviewed me. So they called me up like while we were there. And they're like, hey, can we pick you up and bring you to the studio to film this episode? And I was like, hells yes. So it was like this really like relatable story of like a pregnant mom with a law degree that doesn't practice law, but films video tutorials on YouTube in her dining room, you know, like, And so after all that, I was kind of like, yeah, this is, I like this. Let's see what we can do with it. But of course, at the time, I still couldn't live off of the YouTube money. We bought our little 5-acre homestead, and I bought a studio building, for my studio, like for sewing and filming my tutorials in there. So we put that on the property, and we really did invest a ton, you know, into growing the business and the brand with the money that they gave me. And so I was still working part time. And so as it went along, you know, by now I had my daughter and I have two kids now, and little by little, as the business started kind of growing more and more, then I was like, you know what? I'm not teaching anymore. Like it got to the point where like the last semester they were like, we'll give you just all online classes. You don't have to come in, but the students love you, you know?
Yeah.
Until I finally just cut it off because it was, you know, you're spread too thin. Something's got to give. And I wanted to really focus on this because my goal was to be able to support my family and have my husband quit his job so we could homeschool our kids and be together, that's all of really us. Cool. I mean,
so, how does the economics then work? Tell me what you want to tell me about it, but sort of how does this happen in terms of all of it?
So I think it has to do with like diversifying revenue streams because you can't expect to make the kind of money that you can live off of and have it be sustainable. I think especially for a creative person, like I can't do the same thing all the time. Mm-hmm. So I could never be in the game of creating inventory to sell. You cannot make enough money. Like I cannot run this business as a business where I have to be literally physically working for every dime that comes in the door, you know? So for me, from the beginning, because there was no book to follow or path that I'm copying or something, I was creating it as I went. And so I was coming up with ways to, how can I up my revenue without having to put more time into it? And so early on, once I was, you know, creating that YouTube audience and that loyal following, I started getting emails from people saying, hey, I have $500. I need to buy a sewing machine. Which one do I buy? Mm-hmm. Whatever I tell them, they buy it, you know? Right. So I was like, how can I monetize this? Right? Because I'm not in the game of inventory. I can't sell you the products. They buy it from me, I'm sure, but I didn't have any capital. This business literally started from nothing, right? And so I started thinking, you know what? These are products that I buy already and use. Let me reach out to these companies and see if they want to pay me to do featured video tutorials. And so this is like 2010, 2011, like early in the game where it was like pulling teeth to get these companies to be like, guys, I have 80,000 viewers, like subscribers that want to see me use your product.
Yeah.
Are you sure you don't? $150, you're not sure, you know, it's not a real, and I'm like, all right, whatever. So, I mean, I'd reach out to dozens and dozens, girl, and I'd get slapped in the face each one. They'd be like, nope, not interested, nope, that's not a legit platform, nope. And I'm like, they're paying ad agencies thousands on thousands, and they're not trying to pay a stay-at-home mom like $150. Like, the video is evergreen. It's going to be on my channel forever. I mean, I try everything to convince them, and it was like, nah. So the few companies that were like, yeah, let's try it. Why not? You know? And they were like, whoa, this is a thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I started monetizing like that because the YouTube revenue, you know, you couldn't live off of it. It was, you know, it paid for gas and some groceries here and there. But I wanted to try and make it more sustainable and to make more money. And so what I started to realize was that my, you know, the more videos I uploaded, the more money I was making because the old videos were still making me money, you know?
They were still making you money off of the revenue from YouTube.
From the advertisements, yeah. But, you know, I only had to film that video one time.
Right.
So then I started thinking, okay, well, what can I bring the people that they will buy directly from me, right? That it's not like a fraction of a random cost or like a royalty or nothing. It was like direct to consumer.
Right.
So I came up with a little like pillowcase dress pattern because this was super popular in my in-person classes. I thought, well, let me do a PDF pattern, right? Because again, I have no money. I'm not going to be printing and shipping. I don't have time. I don't have money for any of that. So it was like, I create an e-document, right? A PDF pattern that I would just email to them and they would pay me via PayPal. Oh, legit. Let's try it. It was easy. It took me like 3 weeks to draft up. I made a free video tutorial to accompany it. And so that went on my YouTube channel. And then I told people, if you want to buy the pattern, so I tell you what sizes to cut the fabrics for all these sizes of kids. Mm-hmm. You know, click this link and go buy it for me for $3. Okay. $3.
Amazing.
When I started that game, those at $3 a pop, I would make like $900 to $1,000 a month on $3 a pop.
Really?
Yes. In 2009. Okay.
Right.
This is like.
Because it was a new thing. Nobody had been doing it.
Right? Now, I mean, PDF pattern market is beyond saturated, you know? Mm-hmm. When I started, it was as soon as I got a sale, I'd have to rush to a computer and email them the pattern because there was no apps like you have now and no systems and no Spotify and no big cartel with the pulley app and all these systems where the payment goes through and it automatically sends them the file. We didn't have that then. I had to manually do it. So I remember going to Dominican Republic on vacation, sitting there with like trying to rig up the Wi-Fi from a nearby hotel and like, oh, I got these sales. I got to email these people this pattern. And it was insane.
That's crazy.
Yeah, because you don't want to keep them waiting. They're like, hello, I paid the $3. Where's my pattern? But there was no automated sending yet.
Right.
And so then my husband's like, you need to do more of these patterns. Like, this is where it's at. You know, you do the work once and you start doing that. And so then it became, you know, what else could I do? What PDF patterns? What else could I do that would have a similar impact and would bring in multiple revenue streams, right? Because if I had 10 like that, and even if I didn't create one for 5 months, those 10 are still bringing me money. Because like I tell people, it's PayPal. When I'm sleeping, somebody on the other side of the world is awake. I literally would wake up every single day and there was money in my PayPal that wasn't there when I went to bed. Like, who doesn't want that? Like, that's legit passive income. I'm not even, you know, the work's already been done.
Right.
Like, till this day, I'm not kidding you, I'm still selling $3 PDF patterns for that same pattern. That's amazing.
It's amazing.
At $3, and I never up the price. I'm like, for what? You know, by now, for what?
That's great.
And so that's how it started. And then we started growing from that and then doing other things and teaming up with other companies. And then, of course, upping my sponsorship rate because I was like, hey, I have 250,000 subscribers now. You know, this is how many eyes are going to see this. This is not a magazine where, like, numbers are going down, readership is going down. Like, people are legit searching for this, looking for this, and watching it, you know, to see your product. And so I started then in 2015. We decided to try something different, right? Because as a quilter, I was looking online and I was seeing that, like, for me personally, it's such like a solitary act. It's you by yourself with a sewing machine and some fabric, probably listening to some music or a podcast. For me or for any, you know, working people or people with kids and stuff, was usually late at night, you know, when you find a little me time to get away. And so it's very lonely. So I started to kind of really start engaging with my audience and seeing like who they were and what was going on. And I see that a lot of the ladies that follow me, and guys too, you know, but the majority is women, of course, were using this kind of as a source of like therapy to feel connected to something out there.
Yeah, hugely,
people
right?
that spoke their same language.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I started to see that a lot of people had, you know, autoimmune disease and had different things that wouldn't allow them to leave their house at any given point in time. So they couldn't just go down the street to the local quilt shop and take a class because they don't know if their end was huge. And so I wanted to launch a club that would make them feel like part of a an online community.
Uh-huh.
And so in 2014, at the end of it, last week of 2014, I launched this online quilt club. Membership-based, monthly subscription or yearly subscription at a discounted rate. I did weekly live streams. So this, I mean, early 2015 to be doing live streams, like not many people were doing that because you didn't have the Facebook lives. You didn't have a lot of the stuff that's out now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so then I would create monthly projects. We would have swaps. We would do monthly interviews with other people in the industry where it's like a podcast or a video podcast. Yeah. Sometimes if they were okay with that, that would, you know, it was just like this all around club that you could be a part of, like a guild, but online, and with a lot much.
How much is it still going?
No, it's not. I ran it for 2 years and we ended it end of 2016. So it was all of 2015, all of 2016.
And so people, how much were they paying to be part of this club?
$17.99 a month.
And how many did you have?
Over 1,100.
Whoa.
So when we launched that club, the first week that we launched it, it was a discounted price. So people paid $9.99 a month or $107 for the year during the launch week.
Uh-huh.
And in that week, we literally, that was what, the last week of December. And by the end of February, my husband quit his job, you know, so it was like, yep, we're done. Holler at the job. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because even though those were the ones that started from the beginning, as word started to get around or people would see their projects, like, oh my gosh, where can I get that pattern? It was like, oh, exclusive club project. You got to be in the club to get it.
All right. So that's amazing. And do you think you were able to build that because you were building your brand so much that people just wanted to? Yeah.
Because, I mean, you can only do so much online on YouTube for free, right? So people that were already loyal followers and loved my teaching style, it wasn't a hard sell. I didn't have to convince them, like, my projects will be great.
Right.
The instructions will be easy to follow. They already knew me. So it was kind of like the next step. And, you know, and at the time, you know, if you have something like that, a following, then you start putting out your own products, right? Because people want to give you money. They like your stuff. They want more from you.
Mm-hmm.
And so because I didn't have anything like that, this was that thing.
Right.
Where it was like, wow, now I can pay her and get so much more from her and of her. And I mean, we were like, but these online.
Hold on, Vanessa, we're having trouble with the internet. So say it again.
It was insane. Then I started doing retreats.
Wait, Vanessa. The sound cut out. So,
hello?
Can you hear me? Okay, let's just back up for just a second because we cut out when you were saying that like the revenue was coming in and things were getting better.
Yeah.
And then we lost you for just a second. So
okay.
So let's just pick up from so the club was successful. Your husband quit his job.
Yeah.
And things were things were just different for you, right? Mm-hmm. Things were financially more stable and better. Is that right?
Exactly. Yep. And so then we started thinking, well, how can we take this online community, right, to the next level? And so I wasn't really someone who traveled to teach a lot. So we thought, well, let's do some of our own quilt retreats for the club members and have them come. And then they get to meet me in person and they get to meet each other, because every week they were chatting together in the live chats, in the live streams.
Yeah.
They were also participating in monthly swaps. So some of them got to meet their swap partner in person, you know, like, oh my gosh, you made me that super cute little mini quilt, whatever. And so we brought it to real life then. And so those retreats would sell out super quick, and they still do. I mean, we started doing maybe 3-4 a year. The past couple of years, we've done like 5 or 6 a year. And this year we're doing the same, about 4 or 5, I think.
That's really amazing. And are they just open to any?
No. So this is what we did. Because they were Quilt Club members, we gave them first dibs on any of my retreats and cruises. Because I did a cruise a couple of years ago, a 7-day cruise. And so I worked that out. You know, that my club members get first dibs. Uh-huh. Then after a set period of time, you know, we say 48 hours or whatever, then we open it up to the public. And so people get really mad, because they're like, how come I see these pictures from these retreats, but I never hear about them? Well, you can't, because they sell out. You know, if I send an email to 70,000 people, by the time you open it, it's sold out. I'm going to get
out
by a million people, you know?
How many people?
So the first one was like, so the first one we did had like 37. Now we capped them off at 20.
Amazing. And they're staying at where are they staying?
I rent a retreat center about an hour from my house. And so they're hotel style rooms, and we have a large room with plugs in the floor. So we plug up our machines, and you know, we have different themed retreats. So it could be a gift making one, a handbag making one, a garment sewing, a quilting, and so it varies.
And how much does it cost to go to the retreats?
It depends. The first couple ones, we really went all out. We had charter buses that drove us to St. Augustine. They got to eat out there. We visited 2 quilt shops, and those were like in the $700 range. Now we kind of bring them down a little bit more. They still include 10-minute chair massages. So I have a massage therapist come, which is great, because you know, you're sewing all day and all night. Then you get to take a little break and get a massage, which is great. All the meals are included, the rooms, you got goodie bags and all that. And they're in the $475 range, $500 around there.
So now that you've stopped the quilting club, will you still have the strategy of giving them first dibs on it? Or what's your strategy?
I do. I still continue to do it, because those are the hardcore,
those are your people.
Yeah. So I still do it. So they, like, right now they're all trying to schedule up together to see who's coming to what, even though the rest of the public has no idea what the dates are. But I give it to them a week early before I open it up for them, because they sell out. Like the retreat we just had this past August sold out in less than 15 minutes.
Oh my gosh.
Just with the first dibs people. So imagine, I mean, I can't put that public, you know?
Insane. That's amazing. It is.
I know. The cruise that I did, we had
Tell
8
me about the cruise, because I'm really curious. I'm totally interested in the quilting vacation, but basically there's so many quilting cruises. So I'm curious about, tell me about that. You there? Oh, we lost you again.
Okay, so we had a little internet trouble. We switched formats to another way to finish out the interview, and we have a part 2 tomorrow about her life as an entrepreneur. It is so cool. So come back. Listen to part 2, and that's it for today. So this is Elizabeth Townsend-Gard. You've been listening to Just Wanna Quilt, a research podcast coming out of Tulane University Law School. We want to hear from you. Join our army, our quilting army. Go to our Facebook page. Suggest people to be interviewed. Suggest yourself to be interviewed. We are excited to hear from you. But most importantly, I hope you get a chance to quilt today.